and your slaves. See that ye feed them with such food as ye eat yourselves, and clothe them with the stuff ye wear. And if they commit a fault which ye are not inclined to forgive, then sell them, for they are the servants of the Lord, and are not to be tormented. Ye people, hearken to my speech, and comprehend the same. Know that every Moslem is the brother of every other Moslem. All of you are on the same equality. This insistence upon kindliness and consideration in the daily life is one of the main virtues of Islam, but it's not the only one. Equally important is the uncompromising monotheism, void of any Jewish exclusiveness, which is sustained by the Quran. Islam, from the outset, was fairly proof against the theological elaborations that have perplexed and divided Christianity and smothered the spirit of Jesus. And its third source of strength has been in the meticulous prescription of methods of prayer and worship, and its clear statement of the limited and conventional significance of the importance ascribed to Mecca. All sacrifice was barred to the faithful. No loophole was left for the sacrificial priest of the old dispensation to come back into the new faith. It wasn't simply a new faith, a purely prophetic religion, as the religion of Jesus was in the time of Jesus, or the religion of Gautama in the life of Gautama, but it was so stated as to remain so. Islam to this day has learned doctors, teachers, and preachers, but it has no priests. It was full of the spirit of kindliness, generosity, and brotherhood. It was a simple and understandable religion. It was instinct with the chivalrous sentiment of the desert, and it made its appeal straight to the commonest instincts in the composition of ordinary men. Against it were pitted Judaism, which had made a racial horde of God. Christianity, talking and preaching endlessly now of trinities, doctrines, and heresies no ordinary man could make head or tail of, and Mazdaism, the cult of the Zoroastrian Magi, who had inspired the crucifixion of Mani. The bulk of the people to whom the challenge of Islam came didn't trouble very much whether Muhammad was lustful or not, or whether he had done some shifty and questionable things. What appealed to them was that this God, Allah, he preached, was by the test of the conscience in their hearts a God of righteousness, and that the honest acceptance of his doctrine and method opened the door wide in a world of uncertainty, treachery, and intolerable divisions to a great and increasing brotherhood of trustworthy men on earth, and to a paradise not of perpetual exercises in praise and worship, in which saints, priests, and anointed kings were still to have the upper places, but of equal fellowship and simple and understandable delights such as their souls craved for. Without any ambiguous symbolism, without any darkening of altars or chanting of priests, Muhammad had brought home those attractive doctrines to the hearts of mankind. Fifth, the true embodiment of the spirit of Islam was not Muhammad, but his close friend and supporter, Abu Bakr. There can be little doubt that if Muhammad was the mind and imagination of primitive Islam, Abu Bakr was its conscience and its will. Throughout their life together, it was Muhammad who said the thing, but it was Abu Bakr who believed the thing. When Muhammad wavered, Abu Bakr sustained him. Abu Bakr was a man without doubts, his beliefs cut down to acts, cleanly as a sharp knife cuts. We may feel sure that Abu Bakr would never have temporized about the minor gods of Mecca or needed inspiration from Allah to explain his private life. When in the 11th year of the Hijra, 632, the Prophet sickened of a fever and died, it was Abu Bakr who succeeded him as caliph and leader of the people, Khalifa, means successor. And it was the unflinching confidence of Abu Bakr in the righteousness of Allah which prevented a split between Medina and Mecca, which stamped down a widespread insurrection of the Bedouin against taxation for the common cause, and carried out a great plundering raid into Syria that the dead prophet had projected. And then Abu Bakr, with that faith which moves mountains, set himself simply and sanely to organize the subjugation of the whole world to Allah, with little armies of 3,000 or 4,000 Arabs, according to those letters the Prophet had written from Medina in 628 to all the monarchs of the world. And the attempt came near to succeeding. Had there been in Islam a score of men, younger men, to carry on his work of Abu Bakr's quality, it would certainly have succeeded. It came near to succeeding because Arabia was now a center of faith and will, and because nowhere else in the world, until China was reached, unless it was upon the steppes of Russia or Turkestan, was there another community of free-spirited men with any power of belief in their rulers and leaders. The head of the Byzantine Empire, Heraclius, the conqueror of Chosroes II, was past his prime and suffering from dropsy, and his empire was exhausted by the long Persian War. Nor had he at any time displayed such exceptional ability as the new occasion demanded. The motley of people under his rule knew little of him and cared less. Persia was at the lowest depths of monarchist degradation. The parricide Kavad II had died after a reign of a few months, and a series of dynastic intrigues and romantic murders enlivened the palace but weakened the country. The war between Persia and the Byzantine Empire was only formally concluded about the time of the beginning of Abu Bakr's rule. Both sides had made great use of Arab auxiliaries. Over Syria, a number of towns and settlements of Christianized Arabs were scattered, who professed a baseless loyalty to Constantinople. The Persian marches between Mesopotamia and the desert were under the control of an Arab tributary prince whose capital was at Hira. Arab influence was strong in such cities as Damascus, where Christian Arab gentlemen would read and recite the latest poetry from the desert competitors. There was thus a great amount of easily assimilable material ready at hand for Islam. And the military campaigns that now began were among the most brilliant in the world's history. Arabia had suddenly become a garden of fine men. The name of Khalid stands out as the brightest star in a constellation of able and devoted Muslim generals. Whenever he commanded, he was victorious, and when the jealousy of the second caliph, Umar, degraded him unjustly and inexcusably, he made no ado but served Allah cheerfully and well as a subordinate to those over whom he had ruled. We can't trace the story of this warfare here. The Arab armies struck simultaneously at Byzantine Syria and the Persian frontier city of Hira, and everywhere they offered a choice of three alternatives: either pay tribute, or confess the true God and join us, or die. They encountered armies, large and disciplined but spiritless armies, and defeated them. And nowhere was there such a thing as a popular resistance. The people of the populous irrigation lands of Mesopotamia cared not a jot whether they paid taxes to Byzantium or Persepolis or to Medina. And of the two, Arabs or Persian court, the Arabs of the great years, were manifestly the cleaner people, more just and more merciful. The Christian Arabs joined the invaders very readily, and so did many Jews. Just as in the West, so now in the East, an invasion became a social revolution. But here it was also a religious revolution, with a new and distinctive mental vitality. It was Khalid who fought the decisive battle, 634, with the army of Heraclius upon the banks of the Yarmouk, a tributary of the Jordan. The legions, as ever, were without proper cavalry,